Hello, this is Zara Richter with the Facing Autonomy Collective, where a bunch of us are reading an excellent essay. It's called Critique of Violence. I am here with my usual co-host Shir, as well as our more recent group member, Tancred Fulconis. And of course, Arturo is often is to give us his super grounded public intellectual perspective.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction, Zara. I'll just hand to Tancred. I'll just say that this is a really important essay, I think, in the current context, a critique of violence. And we see Walter Benjamin sort of in a similar fashion to Marx with Capital, Foucault with Power, sort of trying to understand violence and, how it's undertaken, and how it strikes at power and how it's interwoven, the law and those things. And it has many implications for any insurrectionary or revolutionary project. And I think I'll just hand it over to Tancred after that.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Zara. Thank you, Sherry. It's great to be here. So the text, Critique of Violence by Walter Benjamin, is one that I really enjoy, and I've read it actually in conjunction with as Force of Law for a presentation, a conference that I gave in Melbourne last December. And so basically the text, Walter Benjamin discussing the relationship between violence in relationship to the law, and particularly he starts by laying out the difference between what natural law says about violence and what positive law says about violence, basically saying that natural law says that violence is a product of nature, a raw material, the use of which is in no way problematical unless force is misused for unjust ends. And positive law sees violence as a product of history. Natural law judges all existing law only in criticizing its end, positive law only in criticizing its means. So if justice is the criterion of ends, legality is that of means, justness of ends through justified. And so basically what Walter Benjamin does right off the bat is to deconstruct this opposition between that's often made between natural law and positive law. And he's basically arguing that all law is interested in a moment and not necessarily for legal ends, but rather to preserve the law itself. And so that the law needs violence in order to preserve itself, that violence is basically its raison d'être, its for being. And so basically he distinguishes the two characteristics of the law has two characters. It has a law-making character, so whenever external power force the law to basically capitulate and reestablish a new form of law. And then it has the law, which is the subordination of citizens to the law. So the whole narrative of like everybody is subject to the law reaches everybody, and that is the law preserving function of the violence. So violence is lawmaking and law preserving. So what Walter Benjamin does is to really tie the law to violence and to make no doubt that they are one of the same thing. So I think it's Roberto Esposito in Immunitas who this sketch in three steps. So law is always founded at the beginning by a violent act. Once established, it excludes any other violence or legal paradigm that is exterior to it. And this exclusion can only be carried out by means of fervor to institute, but rather to preserve the established power. So that's in Immunitas by Roberto Esposito. And so basically what we have with this law-making, law-preserving distinction, what Walter Benjamin gets at In liberal democratic society, that the state and parliament forget its own violence. And so there is a certain rot. Something is rotten within the Benjamin is that it forgets its reason of being, it forgets its violence, it forgets that once it was itself revolutionary, it denies its violence and thus it suspends its own reason for being, which is continuation of violence, monopoly on violence, where Walter Benjamin sees sort of the cracks in the liberal democratic establishment is that by forgetting its own violence, it forgets that, basically it forgets to reproduce itself. And it masks its own. And so it basically delegates all power to the police. And so that's why Derrida is able to say that the police is actually the true legislative entity in, that the police is the true legislative entity in liberal democracies. That, later. And then finally, Walter Benjamin makes a distinction between mythical, violence and divine violence. So this sort of mythical lawmaking and then the divine violence that will once and for all abolish all further lawmaking and law preservation. And so the distinction is he takes on Greek mythos by which basically violence is perpetrated in order to maintain power in place. So the Furies exert violence to make he felt, then the gods exert their powers in order to reproduce basically continuation of power. And then he, what he does with, through, divine violence, which we can talk about this more. I think that's an, like the main point probably of our discussion is, that, basically divine, this form of divine violence, which he takes from, messianism and Hebrew, I mean, the Bible, the Jewish interpretation of the Bible, basically what he's talking about is, a violence that would come to abolish by its form, by its very form, that would come, to abolish the state of power. And that is what he considers the proletarian, general strike, which he makes a, so he draws this opposition between the political general strike, which is a reformist act, power versus the proletarian general strike, which is an abolitionist form of violence. So violence that will abolish, that will abolish, basically the lawmaking law preserve, cycle. And so that's where he comes in conflict with people like Sorel, for example. And yeah, that's my very long summary of critique of violence.
Yeah, this that was a great summary.
Yeah, thank you. That was very concise.
Concise and really highlighting all the key components of the text.
And what's interesting to me, as someone who has come out of a syndicalist contingent, I'm part of a syndicalist organization as we speak, is that Walter Benjamin is speaking of this general strike in a way that's quite different from the way you would get from, say, anarchists such as Rudolf Rocker or Alexander Berkman in the anarchist communist tradition. You know, Walter Benjamin is almost speaking of this general strike in a metaphysical sense, just as Georges Sorel is a general strike in a metaphysical sense. And so it's interesting to me as a scholar who has become inadvertently attracted to the anarcho-syndicalist approach to understanding material movements is that the physical aspect to how both Sorel in his Reflections on Violence and this text by Walter Benjamin, they take this notion of the general strike and they elevate it to this almost philosophical, not super material a level, which is so distinct from those who are used to organizing unions, you know. And certainly Derrida, I haven't read his text, but I wouldn't expect him to have a notion of the general strike that is ground work of organizing a union either.
I also think Derrida had some differences with Benjamin in his larger conclusions, which we could get into maybe later on in the discussion.
I definitely agree with what in terms of how he conceptualizes the general strike is very different from this kind of like just like a workplace-based struggle to take over the workplace and manage it more democratically or something like that. Like he's talking about an insurrection destroys state power, which to me, there's a lot to be said about what happened this summer and this fall and how we can think about this distinction between a proletarian, you know, strike and violence and then a, you know, this law preserving violence that just reforms the system. And, you know, we could see it in the shift that happened from, you know, well, maybe July, where people were, you know, burning down police stations and setting cop cars on fire and looting, you know, commercial centers across the country. And, mm-hmm. you know, we could think of this in the way that he's talking about it in a way. But then, you know, the shift that happens towards the more activist-oriented movement, or which you might call a social movement, and the, you know, the nonviolent protests that, you know, become large shows and politicians. And I think there's a lot to be said about, like, thinking through that framework with what happened this past year. And I'd like to, yeah. I wonder, yeah, what people have to say about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting because so Violet, who is sadly not with us, and I wrote an article actually criticizing this whole shift towards an NGO organizers-led, basically forefronted nonviolence at the expense of the actual uprising that was going on. And I mean, we saw in various cases, especially the more disgusting ones with the girlfriend of one of the person who got killed, who burned down the Wendy's and then was basically doxxed by liberals who kept saying that, basically started labeling her as like a Karen, and then realized what they had done, but kept on basically pushing this sort of nonviolent form of protest. And then we saw also when organizers were basically trying to stop people who were trying to prevent arrests, and were basically the cops, and otherwise basically the police has a right to repress us. So I think there is this real like anchored firm belief in the legal institutions as something that is neutral amongst activists. They were to be functioning better than something would, I mean, I don't mean activists in general, but I mean the NGO industrial complex, that some, if the legal system were to be basically run properly, that it would be neutral and efficient, where like this sort of reading and Walter Benjamin's thoughts are extremely important to basically provide another example of why that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, his sort of, his line of questioning is very interesting, where he's sort of like going after George Soros, who, and sort of the ideas of that on a certain level. I think there's so much to it. Like, wants to jump in.
I mean, I think the syndicalists were never seeking democracy in a workplace. I think the people who seek democracy in a workplace are folks like Professor Wolf or whatever, who are left liberals. I think that syndicalism was always seeking to use existing organizations like the Industrial Workers of the World, existing unions, to have a general strike, which is so big, a union strike, which is so big that it does indeed, what the Invisible Committee talks about when they meant that they wanted to abolish time. I think that people in the IWW do want to abolish time, and they're not calling for a workplace democracy the least bit, and syndicalism has never called for workplace democracy. But to manage this kind of divine violence, that doesn't happen you know, that doesn't happen overnight. And, you know, this thing this past summer, it was a quick affair where it was a very fast uprising. It came and it went. Soon the liberals turned it into fodder for the Biden campaign. You know, so I don't see this past summer as an actual proletarian general strike. I see it closer to being, if it is to be a general strike at all. I don't know if it's a general strike, because I think general strikes involve form. You know, if it was a general strike, it was closer to a political general strike, because it used temporary acts of law of law lawmaking violence to observe and make memorable the voices of the black proletarians just as an extortionary, you know, mechanism, I'm afraid, you know. So I think it was an important use of this extortionary mechanism, but it was to paralyze all of industry for over a month, which is what a proletarian general strike seeks to do, is to paralyze the economy, you know, until the workers have get their due, you know. And I think you can't do that without material organization, without the material at each workplace, and finding the radical contingent and getting them to do a wildcat strike. You know, I don't think you can do that just with a protest movement. I don't think a protest is a strike.
It's interesting though, because it doesn't necessarily, like, talking about general strikes. Like, when I see him talking, like, his definition seems to be that the proletarian general strike is the abolition of state power, right? Like, that's the central core of it. What about that?
We agree that it's about the abolition of state power.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. And he doesn't really seem to base it around the workplace necessarily.
The notion of a labor strike is inevitable by Sorol or by Benjamin. It comes from the workplace. It's a labor strike is based on workers in the workplace.
Okay. Yeah.
I think, like, the important distinction is that, you know, the right to strike itself, it's kind of like that Panelcake article, right, where he discusses the tendency within, like, Europe during the early 1930s. The strike had become almost like an apolitical sort of spectacular sort of thing, right? It wasn't directed at power in a fundamental way. It was sort of just it wasn't like challenging value or challenging power, like state power, you know, on a fundamental level. And I think, like, that's been a major issue. I think, like, the IWW in that sense is a great, you know, especially during the 1930s, 40s, right? Earlier than that, right, when they were able to organize across various forms of workers, you know, go beyond a sort of status quo type of union politics.
Tancred, what is your perspective on the labor movement who is in Europe, who has seen a different kind of labor movement than we see here in the States?
I mean, I think it's complicated, because I think it has, if we look at, like, May 68, for example, or if we look at, I mean, I feel like the labor movement can be a driving force, but that in itself, by itself, it doesn't accomplish, like, it cannot accomplish the abolition of completely. I think that it needs something else. And I think that's what we see in May 68 particularly, is that the main unions basically betray the general gist of the movement in order to secure better its rights for the workers. And so in the end, it sort of becomes a movement for itself, in the sense that, like, it seeks to secure better contracts, better jobs, better hours, better, etc., at the expense of a full revolutionary situation. And I think that's also why sort of distaste for labor organizing in the Italian creeping May, and why we saw a decline in union membership in France, simply because they were not feeling their revolutionary potential. And I think, I mean, if we go on labor in general, I think that obviously strike is extremely important, and I think it accomplishes a lot of things. But I think that alone, it cannot alone generate the conditions for abolishing. By itself, it cannot. I don't think it can abolish the law, and I think that's something that's. I think that would be my main critique of Benjamin in that sense, is that this divine violence is something that, not necessarily in theory, but it's something that can abolish the law, but it needs to basically, the start needs to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if I may speak to the most recent supposed general strike that's gone on globally, what they say happened in India that we would be hearing more about if perhaps our friend Violet was with us. I think that what happened in India was at start just a political general strike, as far as a bunch of mainstream labor organizations having a one-day protest, not an actual month-long, paralysis of industry. And I agree with what Tancred said about liberal unions, or what Wobblies call business unions. Business unions are, they are trying to make all strikes be about extortion. They're trying to make all strikes political, not proletarian strikes. And the difference between, Autonomia Operao in Italy, or the IWW in the United States, versus a more liberal labor organization, the liberal labor organizations, most of them have banned striking. Organizations like the IWW or Autonomia Operao embrace the wildcat strike, which is a strike without the control over union bureaucrats, as a major mechanism of struggle. We made a great webinar. I could link to everyone hearing this about wildcat strikes in education workplaces in West Virginia and in California. There was a wildcat strike at University of California, Santa Cruz, just last year. And all the grad students occupy the campus, and they started getting people who are not part of the labor movement involved with them. And they were resisting their mainstream. Their mainstream union was trying to tell occupying the campus, what are you doing, blah, blah, blah. And they were like, no, fuck you, So I think that we see examples of the wildcat strike, which is, to me, the wildcat strike is the seed of the general strike, because the wildcat strike is the form of the strike that doesn't take bureaucrats. It's labor for itself. And I think that's the seed of the general strike. And we're already seeing those seeds blossoming in their dirty patches around the edges of capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd just like to add in that, I think that the paradox that he's bringing to light is that unions or workers were given the right to strike, right? And that sort of, that distinction, right? And, what separates that political sort of strike versus, which isn't geared towards necessarily something insurrectionary or against the state itself, but, then there's the other strike, which, and how contingent these rights are, I guess you could say, is one thing I was looking at.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to agree with what Tancred is. I think there is a critique to be made about the limits of the general strike in the sense that we think of, I think what's interesting about Benjamin, like I was saying before, is that he's not thinking of it exclusively as only in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And, even what we saw in India, it's like the most revolutionary moments, the people that were on strike weren't taking over the workplace. They were literally destroying the workplace. And it turned in, it was like a generalized came out of a lot of these strikes, at least the most revolutionary moments that we saw in the past couple months. And that's what's interesting to me about the way that Benjamin is looking at this concept of like insurrection, a struggle, and it makes him different from a lot of the communists at the time. Is that, and I mean, also now, I mean, a question to ask ourselves is like, yes, you know, there's strikes happening in the United States here too, right? Like there was in the Bronx in this like produce distribution market.
There's like Hunts Point,
yeah, and it's like the biggest one in the world, right? And what came out of that, you know, yeah, was some wage increases, basically like reforms. But I think what happened this summer, you know, where you had people take over entire cities, shut down entire police forces that just had no control over the situation anymore, looting, real damage that has ever been seen in U.S. history through that, to me, points much more towards the kind of way that Benjamin is thinking about the potentials of the general strike. And I think he's more broadly thinking about it in just in terms of rep and power. Mm-hmm. And that's what's interesting to me. You know, like, why is it that now, especially too, like, workers aren't striking in the same way, you know, that they're rioting? And what is the relationship with in the strike?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I definitely agree with your point, and I think it's important. I think we can think about it if we go back to the Invisible Committee as well as Foucault, and I think our last talk. Mm-hmm. I mean, the last time I was here, I would say that basically we talked about desubjectification, and I think that's what a riot is. It's becoming ungovernable. It's desubjectifying. It's basically the normal functioning of life from going about and from, it's basically resisting being interpolated. It's resisting this, the hegemony. It's resisting going about business as usual. Basically creating a huge rupture. And I think that's what is really interesting about Walter Benjamin, in his text as well, is that he's basically talking about how the proletarian general strike is basically desubjectification by which, basically it's pure means. We refuse to make demands. We refuse to make a program. We refuse utopia. We refuse lawmaking. And it's a strike itself. It's a strike for the revolutionary movement. It's a strike for itself. It's not, it doesn't make demands. And I think that's what is, in a sense, like unquantifiable, is that a strike that doesn't make demands can power and basically saying, oh, you need to, like, we're going to give you like compromise on this, compromise on that. And then we'll sort of give you this half-assed response through which you, will be satisfied for 10 more years. And then you protest again. It's something that doesn't, power is terrified of that. And at the same time, it's extremely difficult to put in place because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I think we all came to a sort of revolutionary position somewhat gradually. Like, we didn't wake up one day and be like, let's burn this shit. We all approached revolutionary potential in a gradual way. And so I think that's where it gets really complicated, is like, in order to triumph, need to be on this ground of not making demands, revolting and desubjectifying ourselves, but at the same time, in order to get there, like, it's not something that we wake up one day and, I mean, I don't think it's complicated in that sense. I mean, it's not something that's based on thought anyways, I would say. Like, it's more based on affect than it is on intelligibility or intellectual. Like, in that way, I guess it might be spontaneous as well.
And the question that bears upon us is, at least in the United States, there was this weird fascist thing that went on in early January on this show. And people used all kinds of words for that that all felt terribly inaccurate. They called it a riot. They called it anarchism. All of that doesn't make any sense to me because it was in support of, it was lawmaking in the exception. It was the lawmaking of the state of exception, where it was the you will not trample upon the law of white supremacy, which is the law which is undergirding American society, you know. But I don't think it was a riot either. I performance of extra legal state violence upon itself, you know, in that the cops and the police were involved in it and allowing it to happen, and the president at that time technically was, and it was being encouraged by so many aspects of government.
Definitely. That's a really good point. That's a really good example of law preserving violence.
And so I do think that Benjamin was critiquing that kind of law preserving violence. I think Benjamin, just like Adorno in his same, was also in his study circle, Benjamin was reacting to the Nazis in this essay, and he was reacting to Georges Sorel. He became a fascist syndicalist at one point. You know, he supported the Bolsheviks later, where we can debate if that's fascist or not, but Lenin had secret police too, you know. So Georges Sorel, he found the general strike to be mythical, not divine violence. He thought the general strike was this weird Jungian act that brought back the power of the craftsman in some weird Heideggerian twist, almost. You know, I feel like Sorel's whole ontology of the strike is based in some weird Jungian Nazism.
Interesting. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting, and I think it's I think another person that we can bring in the conversation maybe is Frantz Fanon. And I think that Frantz Fanon has a really interesting conception of violence that as a creative mode of, I mean, innocent is more like Frantz Fanon's violence is more a violence of lawmaking in some ways, but it is also a creative medium by which previously alienated and groups basically break their chains. And I think it's an interesting thing that maybe we can bring into the discussion as well, because I think we have a sort of tree. We have a sort of different sides of it. And I mean, if we add like Arendt, we could have four, but I think Arendt's take on violence is horrible. But we have this sort of, so we have Benjamin's view, we have Sorel, and then I guess Fanon in the conversation.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd just like to ask all you, like, some of this stuff around the law and the role of the police and the military, especially in places, the highly securitized environments where, you know, we aren't talking about the early 1900s anymore. We're seeing U.S., the role of the police. He sort of has a certain, you know, in terms of the police and the military, first the police, he's sort of talking about how that they have a very different history, right? And how they sort of apply violence or uphold the law or those sort of things. And I just wanted to get your guys' comments on that.
I think it's really interesting to bring in Fanon, and yeah, in relation to that too, in the question of policing, because I mean, Fanon's very different. He doesn't like trying to make violence this divine thing to the point where it doesn't even count as violence anymore in the way that Benjamin is. For him, it seems like for Fanon, like violence is just inevitable part. Threat or provocation on power, specifically the racial order, and in, you know, the black proletariat appears as violence. The racial order is structured for Fanon and can't even escape that in the first place. And
yeah.
And then, you know, the question of violence in relation to what does it mean to be human, and who counts as the standard. of humanity. You know, all of that is organized around the state and the economy, and specifically in a racist society, the white man appears as pure people. And no matter what any kind of colonized subject, you know, does in order to threaten power, it's always going to appear as a form of violence. And also as, you know, being against what is the standard of what is seen. And so that's something, you know, to think about, like that whole frame, like it's a phenomenology of violence, which is kind of a different approach. I mean, you know, it's all based on specifically the colonial situation and the way that race structures the way that violence appears, you know, and whether it even appears as violence or not. And, you know, and when we're talking about that, the technical violence doesn't even have to actually take place. You know, like when setting a bunch of cop cars on fire, you know, that's not necessarily violence against human beings. Mm-hmm. But that is seen as more violent than when the cops beat the shit out of somebody for breaking a law.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm rambling. I'm sorry. Maybe this is not
the
most productive.
I would only say that I see Walter Benjamin sort of more in the tradition of like in place with like Agamben, sort of, constituent politics, right? Where it's like Fanon sees like, you know, sort of or nationalist sort of, you know, sort of a, you know, project as sort of the only way out of this, right? And I think like Benjamin probably would say that there's violence, right? In a different way. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I'm being unfair to Benjamin.
Yeah, like I think like for Benjamin it's sort of more the law itself, right? That's the problem, like stemming from how we frame the law to the various that emerge from it, like whether it's the military or that type of stuff. I don't know, like, maybe I'm... Because, you know, like the enemy isn't... The enemy seems to be the state and law. And kind of Carl Schmitt.
Yeah.
What makes this essay by Benjamin such an important contribution to the anarchist tradition is that Benjamin holds this anarchist thesis that the state has a monopoly on violence throughout the whole essay. You know, and he doesn't have to cite Kropotkin, he doesn't have to cite Bakunin, he doesn't have to line marginalized anarchists to do this. Benjamin has enormous respect among humanities academics who are otherwise quite liberal, who just see him as this weird Nazi traumatized Jewish who is just a weirdo, and they don't recognize that, you know, he was quite revolutionary for his time, and for someone who still accrues so much respect among, you know, educated circles, he was quite revolutionary in his insistence that the state has a... I don't think that Benon and Benjamin disagree, and that the state has always been colonization. I in the process of my comrade Arturo talking, I looked up Benjamin's Wretched of the Earth in the section of Wretched of the Earth where Fanon's Wretched of the Earth in the section of Wretched of the Earth where Fanon is talking about colonization as a natural state of violence. And so I think that there is no state that has ever not been colonial, you know, in a certain sense. And so they both about the state having the monopoly of violence, but it's just that Fanon takes on the state from the exterior of the state, whereas Benjamin takes on the state from the interior of the state.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And for Benjamin, everything's violence, right? On a certain level, like whether it's lawmaking, whether it's the parliament, whether it's, you know, the party, you know, anything in that sense is sort of seen as a form of violence, I would argue. I don't know if I'm generalizing too much, but there are different forms of how that violence occurs. You know, he sees it all bound up into it.
Yeah, that's definitely right.
And I think like Schmitt's, you know, like Agamben actually cites this in State of Exception book, like where the whole idea becomes about, you know, like the whole debate between Schmitt over, like Schmitt's basically, you know, it's, you know, these are exceptional cases, right? You know, this isn't that big of a deal, right? And he's like, no, this is what it's all about. And it's kind of interesting, like the only time he uses sovereign in this essay is like sovereign violence comes at the very end, like the last line of the essay itself.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. I don't know what that signifies.
Like pure violence, sovereign violence, like it all becomes interchangeable.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that this very different interpretation for someone who is accepting a kind of Spinozist hold on as the basis of existence comes from a notion of the whole of the whole being of the proletarian as the actual ultimate sovereign, not the state as the sovereign. So I think that Benjamin is meaning to critique Hobbesian notions of sovereignty, because divine violence is not, certainly not, we know from his work, divine violence is not meant to be sovereignty. In fact, divine violence is meant to be messianic time, to cite one of Benjamin's other works. You know, the divine violence is not sovereignty in the least bit.
Right. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Messianic communism might be the coolest sounding version of communism that I've heard. Messianico Marxism. Or eschatological Marxism.
Yeah, so I want to talk a bit about like the war on terror, anarchism, or like the war on everything, drugs, you know, just a little bit in light of this essay. Like, Tancred, what would your opinion be about article applies to that, or what we could sort of see in terms of that? And so like one of the things is like, you know, in terms of both like the biopolitical control, right? And sort of the violence that's taking place in multiple forms, like there's overt violence, like even we see unionists, we see feminists, like we see different organizers, everything, right? Society at large being sort of engulfed by this like war on terror sort of, you know, idea, or you know, how it is, like, you know, the whole, like, othering of it, who has rights, who... That's the thing about Benjamin, like, Benjamin sees rights as a form of violence in itself, right? And right now in Pakistan, like, a lot of people who have been abducted or sitting in at the capital, like, these are, like, working class indigenous people, like, you know, whose, like, families have been sort of, you know, people have been picked up and been missing for years at a time. And we're seeing a lot more people targeted under terrorism, you know, a bunch of things. Like we even saw like when I was doing union activism, like the driver's strike in the railways, they were charged for being anti-state, you know, in that sense. So that whole, these are more difficult, you know, when it comes to like sort of, you know, a new sort of you know, like an insurrectionary politics on a certain level, or revolutionary politics on a certain level.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about.
And just in general, the rule is now changing. You know, like you see in Chile, you know, a lot of people, you know, who went against the military state, and the military state and, you know, the capitalist state are sort of intertwined on a certain level. But in a lot of these cases, is that, you know, due to crisis or whatever you want to call it, capitalist crisis, you know, one of the main means of extraction is through like eliminating certain or targeting certain populations, right? And over here, like capitalism is so bound up in sort of extracting from certain populations and sort of dispossessing others. So.
All of that, you know, just appears as the natural, you know, law of the state and the market. It's not seen as violence, but it is profoundly violent. And then one strike, you know, that's like violence because it poses a threat to power and the monopoly of violence.
Yeah, I mean, for example, when the driver strike happened, you know, I was close friends with the guy in the driver's union, the railway driver's union, and they did a strike, and some of the left unions, everybody called these guys adventurous and this, that, and they stalled the railways for several days. So he told me, and I wrote this down for like an article I wrote at that time. He was like, you know, anyone can strike, but do you have the guts to do it, you know? And that, you know, like, do you have the will to put yourself on the line and actually strike? And that's why strikes, so you see a lot of the unions, they're very, very conservative, even though they have like revolutionary backgrounds, or very anti-dictatorship or those things. And, you know, like they're almost precarious now, a lot of the railway workers, but they just go after their self-interest. And it was kind of interesting to see how, you know, classification of workers, whether they're in the workshop or other places, they were against the strike. But because the railway drivers were pushed to such an edge, they chose to sort of, you know, do that. And that's what, I just think about that, you know. But I do see other forms of like mobilization taking place as well. It's not just, but I'm saying within, you know, it's about control. It's about who has power, you know, those things.
What you're saying about like having the courage or the guts to like go on strike, and then versus, you know, like the more mainstream unions that just want to kind of manage, you know, the workplace and reform relate to the state. You know, I think there's a lot to be said there about what this distinction between proletarian violence and political violence. And also Benjamin talks about like sacrifice as being of the difference, what just makes them distinct. And that kind of reminds me of what you're talking about too. I don't remember exactly like how he talks about the question of sacrifice. It's like at the end. But I wonder if anybody has any thoughts about that.
If Tancred gets back, it would be lovely to hear his thoughts about sacrifice. I know that from someone like Bataille, who is another French thinker, sacrifice gets a heavy treatment in The Accursed Chair. And from the sacrifice of one's mundane self is necessary to achieve a pure experience of all-consuming ecstasy, total and without reservation. I think that there's a certain joyfulness in being willing to sacrifice or to be free of one's excesses. And I think a lot of people, a lot of us who are working a job, our job isn't merely, but it's an excess. It's a lot of extra things to worry about, you know, and that there's a certain liberation in being able to not worry about that. But of course, you know, it's harder to convince those who have a family, have any kind of comfort, to make that sacrifice without something to keep them afloat in that time. You know, and if we talk about a general strike as the entire economy, or as much as we can do of it, as much as we can get of it to stop, at least we would have to have some sort of strike fund to make sure those who are making these sacrifices can maintain the making of those sacrifices for a long enough period of time. You know, I think that you're getting these days, you have some political scientists in mainstream academia suggesting that a general strike is a strong way of making nonviolent revolution, which of course also feels very sanguine with Mr. Benyamin, refusals of work on a collective basis are a strong mechanism for revolution. Even the fascist syndicalist like Sorel believe that. But of course, in this day and age, knowing how to use unions to achieve their ends, I think the fascists have become even worse at unionizing than the leftists or the liberals have. Thankfully, thank goodness they don't know how to unionize. But I think that there's a lot of complexity in this question of sacrifice in terms of a labor strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found a quote where he's talking about it. Just to go back, there's a quote at the end. It's like the second to last page, and he's talking about the difference between mythical violence and divine violence in terms of sacrifice, and it says, mythical violence is bloody life for its own sake. Divine violence, pure power over all life for the sake of the living. The first demands sacrifice, the second accepts it. And then right above that, he has a about this difference, and he says, if mythical violence brings at once guilt and retribution, divine power only expiates it. I don't actually know what the word expiates means. If the power former threatens, the latter strikes. If the former is bloody, the latter is lethal without spilling blood. What does that mean?
Yeah.
What does it mean? One demands, second accepts it. So, mythical violence, the political strike demands sacrifice. The proletarian strike, the divine violence, accepts sacrifice. It's almost, I feel like one is just like, sacrifice is seen as this kind of like spectacle, you know, that is done in the name of some kind of state or some kind of future state, or what you see as your version of the preserving the law. And then maybe we could say that sacrifice for proletarian violence almost accepts that sacrifice is just a part of your everyday life. It's not an external thing. It's not some kind of spectacle. It's just and also specifically, if you're going to rebel and engage in revolt, you know, it's inevitable that there's some kind of sacrifice that comes with it, but that's not necessarily what you want. That's not desired. But it's inevitable. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
Of course, it makes sense to me that a political strike would demand sacrifice, because whenever a strike happens, a business union, you know, it's something where the union bureaucrats get all the power in that situation. They're the ones making deals, top of the union bureaucrats for betraying the workers in those situations because they're trying to make deals with the state. And I think you can see an example of that in the deal that the Chicago teachers have recently made. They made a deal that they would go back to work, essentially, with the mayor of Chicago. You know, we're in the middle of the pandemic right now, and we know that, you know, teachers are being asked, and now that it's February of 2020, and a lot of teachers unions that are business unions are just so happy to go along with Biden and to go along with these politicians who want them to go back to work. And because they're so happy, they're happy to demand the sacrifice of workers who are going to have to go back to schools and catch COVID. And they would have just been just as happy to have a temporary strike for a little bit in order to get bureaucrats more funding or something. You know, they would have been just as happy to use it for extortion for the labor aristocracy. And the business union loves extortionary mechanisms that result in more power directed to labor. But you know, the general strike, it takes care of the people. It you know, the general strike, when people want to throw themselves down to have that general strike happen, it accepts that, but it allows for non forms of general strike activity to take place. And that's what a strike fund entails. Is that if we want to actually get a global general strike going, we have to raise money. We have to do a lot of GoFundMes to get it. So a huge percentage of the working for a month and survive. And that's a huge thing to ask, but we have to think big if we want to demand everything. But divine violence for Benjamin is a violence that is the expression, the will of truth for Benjamin. So it's part of messianic time. It's part of the will to abolish all that exists. So I don't see that divine violence is for patriotism. It is mythical violence that is for the state or for patriotism. It's natural violence that gets around to justify patriotism, but divine violence is the violence of the unheard, ultimately, you know, and so that isn't sacrifice for patriotism. That is the moment of interaction in which anyone can take part. Anyone can join in. And it, you know, that isn't a demand. It's an open call to stand up if you will, you know. And it, you know, sacrifice is everywhere in the labor union. Who dares to be a labor union member by even talking about it out loud? Perhaps by making this podcast, I am sacrificing my employability in the long term, and I don't care. That's fine with me. Future employers, I'm not a giving up my freedom to express myself for job security. That isn't how I roll, you know, and I'm happy to make that sacrifice. And so I feel like the general strike in the future, it accepts the sacrifice of my time and my energy for it. It calls me to organize a union in wherever I am, and it calls me to organize unions everywhere so that we can eventually turn those unions into a force that can abolish the state and can help us escape.
I mean, there is an almost Nietzschean feel to this comparison, in the sense that, like, the first one demands sacrifice as the Christian morality or the Christianity demands, basically suffering and condemns life, whereas instead of affirming suffering in the Nietzschean sense. And so I think it's in the same way, sacrifice, accepting sacrifice rather than demanding it, is something that basically steers away from ressentiment into a productive, creative, actually destructive as well, force and power.
I mean, the way I think about it is, like, literally every rebellion and revolution and revolutionary movement is driven, like, the driving force is this tendency towards, you know, I mean, the way I think about it, I'm like very influenced by C.L.R. James and this notion of self-activity of the proletariat, you know, but it's kind of similar. And then, you know, that in a way always, you know, we gets recuperated, you know, it becomes part of, it, I mean, Benjamin has a part in the beginning of the essay where he's talking about how the state basically takes the violence of the proletariat and turns it into laws, you know, that can prevent proletarian divine violence. Or maybe I'm not wording that the right way. But, you know, I think literally every revolution that's ever happened, every rebellion, every uprising, that is the driving force behind it.
I mean, I think I agree. And I would say that basically, in a sense, every revolution contains the potential for divine violence. And I think that every revolution is driven by divine violence, and that divine violence, rather than being something that is part of a program, being something that is like organized and ordered by an avant-garde, is actually something that is encountered, and it's something that is the result of the social and the creative moment in which people encounter each other in the streets. I think the Invisible Committee talks about this. I think also, if we go back to Foucault, we can sort of sketch out a revolution without planners, basically, where revolutionary moment is the moment where the law is suspended. And I think that it's actually, I'm sure if Violet were here, she could tell this much better than me, but it's this, in the conversation with Maoists, she basically about the fact that reinstoring tribunals, even public tribunals, or reinstoring the law is actually a counter-revolutionary thing, because the revolution itself is actually the moment of suspension. This sort of power, this sort of judicial, this sort of will to judge, in a sense, and that in reinstoring sort of people's tribunal or reinstating a form of power that has been suspended by the revolution. And I think so, in a sense, the revolution is something that is imminent. And in that same way, I think that divine violence, as opposed to mythical violence, that divine violence, that immanence, it's that creative spark that comes out of the encounters in the streets, in the revolution, rather than something that is out of a program. So in order for it to qualify as divine violence, you would have to destroy the state, reproduce something like it. And I think that fascist movements are very much an example of extreme ressentiment and, in a sense, of fascist movements are an expression of, basically, I would say they're an expression of the corrupt, of the rotting of liberal democracy. And liberal, it's the police or the army that becomes the rulers, right? It's the people who are supposed to safeguard from the order. And so in that sense, it's what we're witnessing with states of emergency, and I mean, that is all hidden behind the myth of the rule of law, but we have fascism is the overt emergency that's taking over. It's that is actually the true lawmaking and law preserving element of liberal democracy. That's what fascism is. It's the unabashed rule of the police that doesn't even hide behind a puppet parliament, as we have in Western countries or in representative democracy. The police is just outright ruling.
I mean, once more, Bataille's The Accursed Chair is kind of about this sense in which there's a part of the economy in which there is nothing but just useless expenditure, you know, and freeing of useless expenditure, whether that's non-procreative sex or whatever it is, it's expenditure just for the sake of fun and joy, you know, and when we sacrifice that, you know, there's a certain joy sacrifice at the base of the economy, you know, and then this is a joyful sacrifice that you would get enjoyed by hedonist cynics like Diogenes of Greece. You know, in that there's this of Greece was someone who extolled public masturbation. You know, not that I advocate that in our current society, but that you know, there's a certain joyful freeing of your burden and a joyful unrestrained behavior, which is at the basis of sacrifice. And so I don't see sacrifice as necessarily destructive. It might be destructive on one super microscopic level, in that there is something being cast off, but what is being cast off often is something that is not really functioning any longer anyway, or not something that is integral to the body anyway. And so I don't see sacrifice really a melancholy act, as I think that you would get from some nationalist red badge of courage story or something like that. I think that sacrifice is a joyful, you know, opening up of the blouse to expose one's revolution sort of behavior. I can say that as a bearer of revolutionary tits myself. You know, I don't see it as a sad thing or as something that we should bemoan. I see sacrifice as a joyful freeing act, under subject to the normal, you know, constraints of law and religion and property and morality. But instead, we are in a moment of joy where the shackles that hold us down are briefly as light as.
Wow, that was brilliant.
Just on a final note before we end, I think it's important. I'm looking at the footnotes of the text, and Benjamin uses the same word for violence as force. You know, right. And so I think that's an important thing to highlight. As far as mythic violence, I think it's important to highlight that Benjamin is saying here that mythic violence always looks violent, but divine violence doesn't look like violence. Divine violence looks like liberation. That's what a general strike, general violence. That's Sorel's whole confusion, is that he thinks that people refusing to work is violent somehow. You know, and Sorel was, of course, someone who was very much against worker sabotage of the workplace, because he thought that work was necessary. You know, so I think that divine violence is it doesn't look the way human violence looks. It looks so much different. And I think it's easy for people who don't know the word insurrectionary means, or the word anarchist to mean, they think that those words are completely, you know, descriptive of this nonsense that happened on January 6th, right? But of course, the nonsense on 6th was not for a minute insurrectionary, and it was not for a minute anarchistic, because it was all about keeping retrenching the power of a New York Wall Street and media executive who is Donald Trump, a captain of industry. It's all about retrenching the power of finance capital, not about disrupting power, not about rebellion, which is what insurrection means, but it was about keeping power in a frozen state, and keeping the United States frozen in the Trumpian, you know, version of neoliberalism and Trumpian neoliberalism, you know, and that isn't to say that Biden different from Trumpian neoliberalism, but those people were so afraid of any minute shift in anything that they were willing to unleash the power of the God's manifestation, the power of Trump's appearance. They were willing to unleash it, and people who honestly deserve to be threatened, but not by fascists. They deserve to be threatened by the workers.
We should all think about writing a document that uses this framework to think through the George Floyd January 6th and this like rising fascist, like, you know, right wing insurgency or insurgent tendencies.
I think that would be a really productive and good idea. And then to add on to Zara, the word that Benjamin uses is Gewalt, and so if I am to trust Derrida on this, which is Derrida in words is never a certainty, but it does mean violence, but also it means legitimate power, authority, or public force. So what Benjamin is criticizing in the critique of violence, critique of authority, the critique of public force, the critique of legitimate power. And so I think that's also an interesting thing, because we can read that Benjamin as basically as an anarchist in some respect in that critique. And then I think also that it's interesting, because then it's also this form of divine violence. I'm not certain that he uses the same, I use the same word. But so divine Gewalt would be, as you said, some form of divine power also, in addition to just simply being violence. And then, I mean, I guess it ties back to the question of what is violence as well. Like, is a strike, like shutting down factories, preventing work, is that actually violence, or is violence only spilling blood, or etc.? I mean, that's an interesting forethought as well.
Yes, thank you so much for this conversation. I think this conversation has been enormously productive. I'm glad that Tenkreid has encouraged me to read this text. This is by far the most useful Benjamin text I've ever read. And of course, my professors didn't assign it. Of course, it comes from an anarchist that was the one who designed it. I've learned a lot, and I'm so grateful for this conversation with all of you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, this great tech.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much.
This has been an excellent 13th episode of Facing Autonomy. Again, we're facingautonomy.com. Thank you for listening through to the end, or thank you for skipping to the end, and keep listening to us, because these anarchist divinely violent ideas are ever forthcoming, and there'll be more and more if you keep listening. Thank you.